Welcome to After the Deluge, I'm Justin Cox. Today, we talk Against Me's third full-length record, Searching for a Former Clarity. It was released on September 6, 2005, and it's their second and final on Fat Records. It was produced by Jay Robbins, and it's their first to chart on the Billboard 200, hitting 114. This record's almost twice as long as the one that came before it, and it covers a lot of ground. We've got the snowballing punk scene and record label drama, long nights on tour that seem to be taking a toll, Iraq has gone entirely to shit by this time, and the story we eventually hear on Transgender Dysphoria Blues starts to reveal itself a little bit. I saw the band live a bunch around this time, including once at the Ventura Fairgrounds for a Warped Tour, just a few months before this record came out. And that's the first time I heard the song Searching for a Former Clarity, which, if you've never heard it and it just kind of comes out of nowhere in a live environment like that, is pretty stark and memorable. I remember my friend Tony and I just kind of falling into silence and watching it and sort of having like a holy hell, what was that type moment afterward. And it really got me excited for that record. My guest today is Keegan Bradford, who plays in the band Camp Trash and writes about music for various websites and on Twitter under the handle Franzia Mom. Great name. Searching for a Former Clarity is his second favorite Against Me record. His favorite, which I failed to ask during this actual interview, is Transgender Dysphoria Blues. Keegan has a real natural sense for placing kind of music within culture, within a band's narrative, within like critical reception, and not just with this band, but with a lot of music. But you'll hear what I'm talking about in just a minute. If you appreciate this show and want to support its creation, hit up patreon.com/afterthedeluge and subscribe for $5. You'll get episodes early, and you'll get a short run Against Me zine at the end of the season that I will be making. That's patreon.com/afterthedeluge. You can find me on most social media under the handle Routine Layup. Congratulations to Laura Jane Grace on her engagement last week. Here is my conversation with Keegan.
What God would have done?
Keegan Bradford, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for doing it.
Thanks for having me.
I reached out to you because sometime maybe this summer, you replied or reposted someone on Twitter saying Against Me is somehow still more important and influential than they get credit for, which like in a way that you're pretty good at in terms of using social media, I'd say that synthesizes kind of like an idea I had, which is, okay, now I'm going to make fucking a 9-episode podcast series, all an hour each, to try and get at that. But that synthesizes, like, it feels very real to me. It's like that no one's going to say that they're unimportant. They are important. Right. And yet, can you elaborate on your like potent 12-word tweet there?
I think that no genre of music is as out of fashion right now as folk punk. People like Jeff Rosenstock, his continued popularity and success, by all accounts, because he seems like a fucking great guy who works really hard and makes great songs. But his continued relevance, especially with like Zoomers and younger music fans, means that people keep rediscovering Bomb the music industry, and he still incorporates a lot of ska elements in his music. Jer from Ska Tune Network has done a lot of, you know, viral videos doing ska covers of things. So previously maligned genres when I was growing up, stuff like ska and then emo, you know, post the emo revival era, where it was still very niche, you know, when bands like Marietta and Snowing and Glocomora, when it was happening, it was still very niche. It was still kind of nerd music a little bit, or a little bit outside of even what alternative music and popular music was. It wasn't something that was going to get covered on Pitchfork or anything like that. And now you see that era of emo, in addition to earlier stuff being revisited, stuff like Jimmy Eat World and Sunny Day Real Estate and Mineral now being considered like major classics, when before they were considered maybe just not as hard hitting or as serious as other genres. And kids love it. Kids love emo, but it's really taken off this current couple years on social media.
I like to tell my friend Brooke that actually the band Algernon Cadwallader, they didn't actually exist. Like, that didn't happen at that time. They exist now to talk about how great they were then.
They were very beloved at the end of their run, but they were still, they were doing very independent things, very DIY things. They were playing the videos you see, they're great. They're full rooms, but they're basements. Decidedly, they weren't like selling out big rooms. But as these other genres have sort of like kind of just gained a little bit more respect and and found audiences and kids going, well, it's not really important to me what the critical reception of this was. I really enjoy this. And now you see like the Hotelier and Foxing going on tour and selling out big rooms for albums that were at the time respected by a few, but not really considered by the rest of music media. The one thing, one of the things that has just absolutely not had a resurgence like that is folk punk. There's a lot of reasons for it. I think one, it's insanely sincere. It's like deeply corny in its kind of ties to like straightforward, like anarchist political messaging, which is both not corny in its essence, but oftentimes the messaging is so blunt and, kind of flag waving. I think that it kind of turns kids off because it's not subtle. It's not nuanced. It's very brash. And it wasn't about really the quality of the instrumental performance or the vocal performance as much as it was about being kind of loud and fast and urgent.
It's often deliberately grating on purpose. Like it wants to annoy you at least some of the times when I hear it. And I'm inclined toward a lot of folk punk music. Sometimes I'm like, half the point here seems like you want it to sound bad, but
yeah, there's an inherent abrasiveness to it. And it was also just like the type of music that there's a lot of bad versions of, because the template of like cowboy chords and chuggy strumming and kind of the gruff, beardy, org core shouted vocal thing, it was so easy to imitate that there quickly became just like so many.
That's a good flat call.
Uninteresting versions of it. So it's really hard, I think, to go back and get into it in hindsight, because there's not really a roadmap for like what the classics are, what you're supposed to find, because it doesn't have that kind of canonization or like history to it. And you can find people who can tell you about it and who have a lot of interesting things to say about it, but it truly doesn't exist in the kind of canonized way a lot of other genres do. And so you'll still see kids get into bands like Defiance Ohio or Spoonboy or like really great stuff. But it's, I understand why something as kind of unsubtle and fist in the air is not resonating with kids who live in a kind of more complex and depressing reality in some ways.
That's a good point. Well, now I'm going to have my eye out to see if someone can do it, if it can be up next for folk punk music. But a thing to add to that, though, is that, and it's evidenced by what happened with Against Me when they were one of those bands doing that in Florida, they felt bigger than that at every time. They're just getting plucked out of whatever phase they were in, out of like, this is just irresistible. This is just, it's yelling and it's like, clearly there was just something there. Even these like A&R guys and stuff like that we've read about and heard about a ton in the recent years, I think they just liked it. There's like, this is just fucking good.
Yeah. In many ways, that was Against Me's big problem early on as a band, over the kind of that middle period of their career, was that they were constantly getting plucked out of their pond and placed somewhere bigger. And that was kind of alienating to both sides of their audience. They were struggling to meet the expectations of like label and A&R people who really thought that they could kind of polish this and get sort of like an offspring out of them or something like that. Or like, you know, there's these West Coast kind of punk and pop punk bands that were just huge commercial successes. And I think that there was this idea that you could take this band from Gainesville and expose them to a larger audience. And then maybe that could happen because they had obviously the ability to write hooks and write choruses. Yeah. And that set them apart from a lot of their peers. But every time they got kind of pulled up to the next tier, their existing fan base was super hostile.
I think this album is an interesting juncture along that journey. And so let's go there. I got an animal doing something at my door real quick.
You can have it all. I got the heart to fight. No. Total exhaustion, complete breakdown.
My entry point to Against Me is high school. Let's see, freshman year for me would have been 2004, 2005, something like that. And they were impossibly important to Florida music at the time. As far as music on the internet goes, it's primarily MySpace music and things like that. There's not really the same function of social media, like Facebook's the biggest social media. They were kind of a breakout from Florida, which is a place where bands often just get born and die without breaking out, just because geographically you're cut off from the rest of the country. If you want to play Tampa, it means you're going to travel for, you know, 7-8 hours down into Florida and then back out again. And that means a day off tour, because Florida is so skinny. So you drive down, you can play Orlando, Tampa, or even if you want to go all the way to Miami, but then you play 2-3 shows and you have a full day off to get out of the state. And especially in the era where you were, where people were just punk bands touring in vans, or were just doing it themselves, which, I mean, still happens, but I just mean in an era where that was kind of like the only option for a lot of people. A day off was just burning money you didn't have, and you could not afford to just drive around and not play shows and not make money that day. So they were kind of like a band that was becoming very big. It's very funny. There was a lot of conversation about them in my high school. It was a band we talked about. It was a band that we listened to. It was a band that we were interested in where they were going. I mean, it sounds fake now. It sounds like a thing that would be an internet message board. There was a lot of like actual debate in classrooms I was in about against me saying that they would never sign to a major label.
Yeah.
And then doing it, because you can't really find it anymore. There's not as much record of it. But Laura Jane Grace back in the day was open about DIY music and wanting to work through independent labels, and had said things along the lines of never going to sign to a major, never going to take the band to a major.
They may, I mean, the predecessor to this record is them making a tour documentary that's them being courted, and then them not signing to that major label, and then making this on Fat Records. This is record two on Fat Records. It is cool going back to it. I know, obviously, like Casual Sex with Multiple Partners is like very much about it, but it's half a dozen songs or maybe more, either directly or obliquely getting at that internal, like, it's talking about like write about what's happening in your life. That was definitely happening in their life.
Yeah. This is in many ways the best record ever about arguing on the internet. This is like a direct response to forums, to the B9 board, to like people just talking about them on the internet and what the response was. There's like a review from the era from something called Scene Point Blank, which I wasn't familiar with, but this is the era where Against Me goes out and tours with Green Day. And they had left No Idea for Fat Wreck for album two. But then around this time, they were also redoing Crime, taking it off Planet X Records, which was a mail order record label that was really, really a significant presence in Florida. We were very invested in Planet X Records. The label's footprint has largely disappeared because owner Chris Clavin, who played in the band Ghost Mice, was outed as kind of a very serious abuser and shitty person.
Yeah.
And so Ghost Mice was a really important folk punk band at the time. That was a really central band in that scene. And so a big problem with the history of folk punk is that so many of those guys and those bands coming from punk scenes and, you know, train hoppers and drifters and people just going from place to place, a lot of those guys got outed as being just shitty people. And so a lot of those bands and those labels have sort of disappeared, been wiped. But at the time, Planet X Records was hugely important. It was a mail order record catalog, and we would buy stuff off the strength of it being on Planet X.
Right.
That's where I heard about Paul Baraboo. That's where I heard about Ghost Mice. That's where I heard about a lot of these bands. And Against Me originally was one of these flagship bands on Planet X.
All those that you just listed off are ones that I read about in a, like this, this person who wrote this alternative press magazine article I read in 2007 or 8 probably just scooped it all up from Planet X Records, basically.
Yeah. And yeah, that was a scene that coalesced around folk punk and had originally released the Crime EP. And then I think that they were re-releasing Crime. And a lot of people right around the time of Axl Rose immediately, this is so funny because we talk about the backlash they got for signing with a major label, and we're talking about the jump to Warner Brothers, but it had happened already when they moved to Fat Wreck. There was already a minor backlash in their fan community to the point where people were actively harassing the band, were trying to disrupt their shows, were trying to like expose the bands for being frauds somehow. Folk punk, like I said, at the time was really associated with like anarchist punk and stuff like that. And a lot of that was associated with like any attempt to get paid for what you were doing right. was crass and was fake and was bullshit. And nobody talks like that or thinks like that anymore. Mm-hmm. But it was very serious and it was very sincere. People really thought that if you, we talked seriously about bands selling out. We hated that. We thought that it was bad when a band did something that had clear commercial goals. And now that feels a little bit like a naive perspective, but we really resonated with the authenticity of bands doing something that was unpalatable to a larger audience yeah. and sticking with that, even though they could make more money and choosing not to. And whether or not it's a good value to hold, or that's a little bit corny in its own way. When they went with Fat Wreck for album two, there was already a backlash among people I knew in Florida.
It's a miserable ascent for them. It's just every step of the way, no right or wrong. And I do think that the spirit of what is trying to be policed there is not worth just discarding entirely. Like, but it, I don't know. Here's a question that like you saying that made me think of a little bit of an aside, but like, I'm trying to contemplate right now, whether it's a net positive or negative on like individuals trying to make art and music, the sort of glamorization of Fugazi, of $5 shows and just everything that is Fugazi. Cause it is admirable across the board. It is admirable, but at the same time, how many people have like internalized that and before they can even get popular enough to be judged by other people like Against Me did, just stop themselves, you know?
Yeah, I think it's just an old guy phenomenon. I think that it doesn't happen like that anymore. And part of that is because regional music doesn't exist the same way. You know, you don't yeah. have local scenes quite the same way. And there's like not CD money. And I think it can't yeah. be overstated how different the world is post CD. Because if you were a band that even on Planet X could sell CDs to kids, you could make money. It wasn't a lot of money, but there was actual money. There was actual checks that were coming in. You were reaching a smaller audience, but making more money.
Right.
And I'm not trying to say that CDs were like a bountiful era for punk and independent music, but there was a different kind of money to be made.
Yeah.
And you could just sell CDs to your fans and make some money doing that. Now that there's no money in physical media, the question is, you can do something as a purist for your fans, but if you can't make any money doing it, nobody can afford to do it. And as you yeah. get older, a lot of people phase out of the age where they are train hopping, where they are kind of living in vans and touring around and stuff. And then you go, do I stop making music or do I find a way to make sure that I can afford to make music just in terms of being able to
yeah.
even have the time off to go play music for people means that you're not working a job. So you've got to be able to feed yourself and pay your rent back home somehow.
Well, I think that I love the way you put this as the best album ever about arguing on the internet. Speaking of that, like casual sex with multiple partners back when like a month or so ago when it was like Rosenstock and Albini and Laura Jane Grace was on it, like talking about merch cuts. Mm-hmm. I was like, this feels like, so it was like these tweets feel like song lyrics off casual sex with multiple partners. Like they're like line iteming. They're like what these venues yep. are taking and everything. And it's a good,
that song is really funny because this whole album, like Mediocrity Gets You Pairs, is like a scene politics song, but it's basically them saying, okay, fine. Fuck you guys. We suck. Who cares? Like, we don't care what you say yeah. about us. Fine. Fuck you. We suck. And that's a classic Against Me song. A lot of Against Me songs are our fans hate us and we don't care. Excitement, excitement. Nothing really excites me. There's no connection at all. No connection at all. But many great Against Me songs in that vein. But Multiple Partners actually lists out like the cuts, how many points, it talks about points on a record, like the price, literally the price of fame. It's so funny because part of it is intentionally provoking. They're literally doing what their fans hate. They're saying, mm-hmm. look, we're actually going to talk about being on a label and we're going to talk about that we are actually marketing ourselves. And we want you to know that we're not actually making a lot of money doing this. Like everything we do costs us.
It's somewhere along this line, there's a process of knowing like, fuck it, we're going to sign. somewhere, maybe not while they made this, but maybe, you know, mm-hmm. we're all living like shades of gray. I bet it was really, really helpful to put that stuff out on the table and just like, I'm just going to process this publicly in front of you and whatever. People are still going to get mad. Someone could say, oh, that band Against Me was not about that. They were never going to do that. Listen to the lyrics of the song Reinventing Axl Rose. And then they did that. It's like, no, there's like basically this album, especially worth of like journal entries saying this is all complicated. There's no winners in this. Like it's, I don't know. I want to keep getting into the songs on this record, but a thing I want to give my background feeling on this one, because I was really into Eternal Cowboy and went backward from there. And so this was my sort of like, we're up to the real moment of when I'm going to get a new Against Me record. And so there's anticipation builds and everything like that. And I remember getting it.
The first Against Me record I was like cognizant for the rollout of. I got this into the same way with Cowboy and went backwards. And then this was the first one I was there for like the single rollout.
Same. I remember really being excited, loving it, and like hearing Miami, and like it goes for 45 seconds before it clips into like what's an actual song, which is like unheard of based on the previous record. The previous record, you're halfway through a song in those 45 seconds, and just there was, and then it's ending with all these horns and stuff, and it felt like some kind of bigger swing or whatever. But then I remember listening through it, it contextualized the way I listened to it, and just thinking like, I really love a lot of this, but it feels bloated. And I think they've even said that or whatever, but it's been interesting coming back to it, because I actually think that less now than I thought then, like on revisiting. But it is where Eternal Cowboy feels like it just does this thing. It just puts the pedal down and zips through in 25 minutes or whatever. This one, you can identify individual songs and moments about the record industry stuff, punk scene drama stuff, external war and politics, not just like anarchist ethos stuff like that, but like actual things that are happening with the government and the war and everything. And then drugs and addiction. And then some of the gender stuff that was like to be coming later, that like in the moment I didn't hear. I mean, I heard it on the final song, but like all of that's there. And I think maybe that can be a little bit of a recipe of like, wow, this record just literally goes everywhere and feels like a lot. There's a lot there when you come back to it in this way and listen intently this way. What was it like coming back for you?
Yeah, it's definitely too long. It's like, it's 47 minutes. Nothing else even came close to like clearing 30 minutes prior to this. And I've always felt that this record just had too much in it, that it was just because like, and a part of that is that the songs are long as fuck. Like the first four songs, three of them are about 4 minutes. And like you said, Miami kind of takes its time getting going and becomes kind of like this barroom bruiser, which is just not every, like TSR is just this like a minute and 20 seconds of just gas pedal. And that was everyone's favorite kind of song from them, was kind of these like raucous, straight ahead, no stops. And then Miami does take its time and then end with like ska horns and build out kind of I used to hate Miami as an opener because it's just not my favorite song on the record, but it actually, I think is a great statement, because it's not actually lyrically about the record label stuff or the scene politics stuff as much as it is a less provoking way to say, hey, we're also doing something different as a band now. We'll get to addressing our various haters in a minute here, but we want you to first see that like we're kind of pushing our elbows out a little bit, making a little more room for ourselves and doing something different.
It announces what's coming in that way.
Yeah. And they recorded this with Jay Robbins, which at the time they were accused of like over polishing this record, which is funny now because Jay Robbins is like a legendary independent producer who does have a pretty shiny production style. I guess sonically this is closer to his band Burning Airlines than it is Jawbox.
Right.
But still, Jay Robbins is not like a name in gloss and shine.
Not Butch Vig.
Yeah. Although they did work with Butch Vig also.
That's what's coming. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think with Miami, I think it's, I obviously heard that song and you hear this sort of like depiction of things falling apart or of like kind of this, but I never really registered until reading the lyrics during this, that it's like, it's a fucking great use of, I don't know if it's analogy or metaphor or simile or whatever. Simile, I guess. Like, we're going to list all this stuff off and kind of paint all this picture like in these verses. And then the Miami, all it is like Miami, you know, all mm-hmm. that stuff we just said, like Miami,
Shithole.
And the antibiotic side would get all the drugs to strangely sober in. The skeletons in your closet have opened the door and they've started talking. Just like Miami, fucking Miami. Shock, shock land for the theater.
It's very funny because Miami is its own Florida. There's like different parts of Florida. Central Florida is different than coastal Florida. And then the Panhandle's its own thing. The Panhandle at the time was actually a huge folk punk scene. Dave Dondero, who was in the band Sunbrain, which is kind of the style that birthed Connor Oberst.
Mm-hmm.
Connor Oberst used to talk about interviews. He won't now, but he cribbed his whole vocal style from Dave Dondero and Sunbrain. He used to mention Sunbrain in interviews, and now he doesn't because I think he realized that his early stuff is maybe too close to Dave Dondero.
But awesome.
Dave Dondero's a legendary songwriter. He's still around. He still
love it.
I mean, if you have a chance to see him. He has like hundreds of songs, and I went to see him. There was like 10 of us there. It was about 2 years ago. He just did requests. He just said, name one of my songs and I'll play it. Name a cover, maybe I'll play it.
God, amazing.
And Dave Dondero moves down to like Pensacola, and then you get like This Bike Is a Pipe Bomb and other kind of Florida classic folk punk happening there. And then Gainesville's up North Florida, much closer to the Panhandle. And so a lot of folk punk's happening there, but Miami has always been its own world entirely. Nobody touring really goes to Miami. You'll notice only major bands really go to Miami because there's so much dead time. Like from Tampa, which is like the closest major city, you could play Fort Lauderdale, I guess, but there's not as many. It's not a big city. So from Tampa to Miami, it's like 9 hours. That's a huge.
Yeah, going to Florida is one thing, but going all the way down to Miami is not. Yeah, that's a whole other deal. Like I'm originally from California, and that's one you can come down in through Portland and zip back out over through Phoenix or whatever, and you could hit the whole thing without being inconvenienced.
Yeah, there's like entry and exit points, but Florida is just an up and down. So Miami's always been its own world, its own culture. It's much more affiliated with dance music and like a party scene. And I think that was in many ways sort of like an easy target for punk bands to joke about the kind of glitz and gloss of Miami. But there's something about the way that Laura Jane Grace articulates fucking Miami and just says it like way too articulately, that's so funny to me.
It really is. It's kind of like you just said, that song is setting a sort of scale and everything of the record. And then the cover, I don't know, I can't like fully literally interpret the cover, but between track one being Miami and the cover having this palm tree, like it's doing a lot of like work at the entry point of like the record you're about to take in subtle way.
Laura Jane Grace has said that they got in trouble with Fat Mike for the cover because he was like, just put the band name bigger or something. It's just like, this is so sparse. It's not like, it doesn't look like a punk band at all. But like Florida is an essential part of who this band is, which is hard to explain because it's the part of Florida that's essential to them is not the coast or the bay or like the water. Against Me is much more a part of landlocked Florida, which is very different. And very, there's a lot of, between the major cities in Florida, there's a ton of rural Florida. And it's not rural Florida, it's populated by retirees and people moving down. It is really kind of towns that are there because trains used to run through them. And now they're kind of small, kind of hard scrabble towns in central Florida. And there is a way that Florida is like super important for Against Me. And there's also a way that they are identifying themselves as a different kind of Florida. Yeah. As like, we are not the Florida that you're thinking of. We are a very Florida band, but it's our Florida. It's not yours. And then by song two, we're already getting into the second line of the second track. Laura Jane Grey says, we're only in it for the money, in like a very sassy, sarcastic way.
You can hear, you can hear a little thing happening in her voice.
There's a target on the audience. Totally sold out.
biggest middle finger, because what we don't have anymore is bands really fighting with their fans the same way.
Yeah.
But she was very much saying, so on one level, this record's super much more polished. Jay Robbins did a great job. It sounds much bigger. It sounds roomier. It's much slower. It's a very mid-tempo record for them. In fact, it's more mid-tempo than probably anything else they've ever done.
Sure.
And it's like almost sluggish in places, and it's confrontational. It is very glossy on the one hand and then confrontational in another way, where they're actively telling their fans, this is who we are now. And if you don't like it, we don't need you. We don't know who else will like it, but we don't fucking need people telling us how to do what we do. Last line, it was better in the basement.
Yeah, that's good. All right. So this is your first one, rollout entry point, and you I think you said it's long. I do want to do some like, how would we shorten it? Like, we don't have to do that, but like, I found that harder than I thought it was going
to
be.
So that's exactly what I felt. I was yesterday trying to do it where I was like, maybe if I resequence this or cut some stuff out, it will feel more like it flows. And there are less immediate cuts than I thought there were.
Yeah. I'll tell you mine. And then if you have some way, mine, I don't think it's necessarily even right. But what I realized is the part where it feels long, the part where it allows me to feel like it's long, is Violence, which is long. It's not really an indictment on the song, but that's as long as the first three tracks on Eternal Cowboy in one mid-tempo song. And then Pretty Girls is, I think it's like the most underwhelming chorus. There are things that cannot be undone. There are mistakes that will never be forgiven. So I think what I would do is I'd chop directly from the middle, from Her Lips to God's Ears. I'd put that on one of like the anti-Bush Fat Records things. Put that there, and then take Violence and Pretty Girls out. So you just take this middle chunk out, and now I think we're at 11 songs. That's my cheap and easy way to do it.
I think that the stuff that is obviously aged the funniest is the Iraq War stuff. At the time, it felt much more essential. At the time, it felt very urgent. Like it was like very much a moment where it was not corny to be anti-Bush, anti-Iraq war. Like, everybody you knew thought the Iraq war was super necessary, and it felt really controversial at the initially to say something different. By 2005, when this comes out, it's a little bit less
it's sour,
shocking. So we're still in the middle of the Bush era. So the majority of political opinion is on that side, and it still felt important somehow. At the time, Sonic Youth was like, on their website, you could download stencils that said fuck Bush, and you could like spray paint it on things and upside down American flags. That's all still part of it. But it's hard now to get excited about a song like Justin, which is a pretty broad swing at the Iraq War. And it is so fucking funny that From Her Lips to God's Ears is... the chorus is just Laura Jane Grey singing Condoleezza over and over again. Condoleezza! Condoleezza!
Condoleezza! What are we gonna do now? I remember thinking at first, like, why are we singling out Condoleezza right now? Like, this was this period of time. It's like, I'm in college. I should be fucking around and just. Like, I shouldn't know who the entire George W. Bush cabinet is. And I knew Ashcroft and Rumsfeld and Cheney and this. But it is, you give that song the time and attention. What you get is like, these are all a bunch of old boy assholes, and you're doing this different thing by being in that. And like, so I get it. That said, like, the catchy melodic chorus that just says Condoleezza over and over again, I'm like, please get out of my head. I don't want this just ringing in my head.
So funny. It's a song I like and I'm simultaneously annoyed by. It's like it's a perfect encapsulation, I think, of what's great about, especially Early Against Me, is the fine line between being electric and irritating.
Mm-hmm.
Just this way that they're like intentionally abrasive and want you to be upset and want you to be kind of in some way react against what they're doing, and the way they want to create like these big fist pumping moments out of these things.
Yeah.
I think also the time, it probably, it feels so much stranger in 2023 having, you know, we still kind of relitigate who those real war crime dogs were, but we don't talk like Condoleezza fell out of, you know, the political circuit much earlier than the other guys did. And so I don't think a lot of kids are really, at the time she was noted for being a flagrant liar. Like a big problem that people hated was that she was coming on TV and saying things that were so flagrantly untrue. Yep. She felt like kind of a mouthpiece for that in a way that now it feels a little bit dated.
By the time like 4 or 5 years after, like post Obama, Condoleezza was like being considered for like 49ers GM jobs and stuff like that. I may not, I may misremember this a little bit, but she's in a way that those other guys just kind of went off still in the context of what they were. I mean, she came out not just being that, not just being what she was in that cabinet.
Yeah. You know? She made an effort to rebrand as a popular figure. And I think that that is why the song feels kind of so dated now. But I think that those two are the ones that obviously feel kind of the most connected to that era. But I think I agree with what you're saying. I think that Violence is just is a good song and is very, very long. And we also have How Low, which is a song with a very similar vibe and a much harder punch. The portrait painted in Violence lyrically is much more broad, is kind of this vague sense of dread and what are we going to do now? And then How Low is like very directly about addiction in a way that is like actually has an impact and actually feels devastating. There's like a couple ways to write about addiction, and much of it feels like it's tough to relate to, or it's difficult to translate exactly how devastating or serious it can be. But my friend Jay, Listen Up Nerds on Twitter, tweeted the other day that he was listening to the original version of How Low, where Laura lets loose and makes it sound like a Bender feels.
And I'm sick of feeling like I'm losing my mind. Sick of doing the same thing night after night. Sick of self-loathing and self-absorption. Self-destructive narcissism. I'm sick to death of being constantly fucking sick.
And I think that's great because there's just this, on the Total Clarity version, which is kind of a louder, kind of more full band version, there is this like dry mouth, heavy eyes, end of a 2 or 3 day stretch where your body is just slowly starting to kind of give out and you're going to inevitably come down despite your best efforts. And I think that How Low for that reason cuts a lot deeper than Violence to me.
Yeah, I agree. Shit, I'll cut that Total Clarity version in. Hey, how low, like, is, it's weird to say this because it is extremely, it very starkly depicts this person moving through these scenes that is just unsustainable and deteriorating yourself. But at the same time, the like, at least the album version, I could send that song in the way that I couldn't send most Against Me songs. I could send that to my alt country loving friend. I could probably send it to my dad. I could probably, there's a whole, in a certain way that I'm like, I don't know, this is maybe almost Against Me going too far in this direction for what I want on Against Me record. But at the same time, it's like, I can't actually hum or summon exactly what Violence sounds like right now. Like, give me 10 seconds and I could, but How Low is instantly there. Like, I know exactly what How Low is. It's a really great and devastating song.
Yeah, and it's them shifting a little bit from folk punk, which is taking like these cowboy chords and cowpunk structures that are kind of like fast and straight ahead, and like actually slowing it down to the actual kind of country cowpunk stuff that is really tuneful. That is much closer to like singer-songwriter stuff. And you can tell the Total Clarity version, I think, was their pass at making it an Against Me sounding version of it. Like, maybe we punk it up a little bit, it'll feel more like us. But I think that the choice to go with this version of How Low was a good one because the song thrives off of that melody being central. The Total Clarity version is really raw, but the How Low version is really naked. And I think that's what makes it such a tough listen sometimes.
Yep. It could be just that it's this naked that it really shines through. But like when the drums come in, they sound so damn good. And then the bass line is irresistible throughout that song.
How long?
great to be able to hear the bass on this record.
I noted the bass more often than I do on a typical Against Me album, I think.
Yeah, Andrew Seward joins the band on The Eternal Cowboy, but this is the first record where you can hear his contributions on bass, really, where it's like highlighted out more. It's a really great point for the band because he can drive a lot of the melody of these songs in a way that requires less frantic strumming, and kind of the song can drive without just that basic rhythm. You're coming off kind of contrived and pretentious. You're not saying anything we haven't heard before. You got up in an argument. Oh, you're so lost in modern art. You will lose it all, and you will find again. Don't lose touch. It might not feel like a huge departure now compared to what came later, but at the time, this record was super divisive. When you play Miami, it's not super clear why. It's like a different song for them, but it's sort of very much a piece of their, with their energy, with their vibe. But one of the reasons this album was so weirdly received was because the decision for the first single was Don't Lose Touch.
Yep.
Which also had like a produced music video of them in a white room. You know, it's pretty minimal, but it's definitely a well-produced music video, very consistent with the kind of thing you would see on MTV and VH1 at the time.
Yeah.
Don't Lose Touch is, a lot of fans refer to this album as being an album they don't like because Against Me sounds like Franz Ferdinand.
Bouncy,
which is so funny because one, Franz Ferdinand is not a reference anyone would make in 2023 to compare bands to, but they were huge, they were fucking massive at the time.
Yeah.
And Unprotected Sex with Multiple Partners has this little funky riff thing and bouncy bass line that a lot of people hated. People, when they heard it, just wrote the record off, thought that this was the band selling out, doing a dance punk thing that was very popular at the time, like Chick 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 and all those other bands were doing, like The Rapture were doing dance punk, and it was looking like Against Me was going to lean into that kind of popular music direction that was kind of funky and vaguely British. And
I think right around that time, like Float On is happening too. Like a lot of these things kind of felt like this very uppy downy type thing.
Yes. Very kind of like a couple note repetitive lead that was kind of funky. And although now it's like the second most streamed song on that record. So people came around on it. But at the time it was viewed as a signal that Against Me was kind of,
I think it's the ultimate, like, for all the people it turned off, it gained, it brought in others, you know. But I think, real quick, hold the point that you're going to go to in a second. There's one, I'll cut it in, I'll find it. But there was even a nu metal type song, type band. I think Finger 11, maybe, or whatever that would be. But I swear to God, there was a song that was cribbing this style we're talking about. It was like, oh, damn, Franz Ferdinand does a nu metal track. I'll find it. So continue on.
I hold on so nervously to me and my dream. Those Franz Ferdinand comparisons, this idea that it's becoming too much like pop music, regarding Unprotected Sex, but I truly think the song it might actually apply to is Don't Lose Touch.
I agree.
For better and for worse, that's a dance punk song. That's like that's a pop song. It's very bouncy. It is super sparse. It's a lot. It's bass driven. It's got the bouncy drum beat, and it is goofy. I think that it's a great song. It feels like the biggest swing at a pop song they had done until that time, 100%. And for it to be the first single that came out with a video, I think it gave people a very different idea of what the record is and was going to be. I think the most surprising thing about it is how good they are at it.
I'm losing touch. I'm losing touch. I'm losing touch. I'm losing touch.
Yeah, they nailed it. I agree. It doesn't feel forced. And it's like, while we do this little thing, we're also going to be commenting on this whole evolution process of like our relationship with fans and art and ourselves and self-identity and all of that. It's like, it's the song is saying something relevant to what you hear on this.
Yeah.
Record.
It's saying that what you're hearing obviously is very different, but we believe that we're still in touch with what we're doing and what matters. I also think that the whole arc of their journey through Fat Wreck is completely different. If the first single from this record is Problems, I believe if they had released Problems as the first single, that sounds like an Against Me song. It's fast. It's straight ahead. It's one of my favorite Against Me songs ever, but it's much more at peace with what you'd expect from them. Yeah. And I think if they had just gone with that instead, the entire reception around Searching for Reform or Clarity would have been, oh, this is Against Me doing a big, long, you know, different album. But I don't think the Franz Ferdinand comparisons and the kind of dunking on them as a wannabe indie pop band would have played out the same way. I Don't Lose Touch was a very calculated choice and maybe the most confrontational thing they did regarding this record.
Yeah. The thing that you hear first is going to paint your expectations, and it's always going to be there as you process the rest of it. Problems. What I'm trying to remember is like, I might have heard Problems maybe like third or something like that. I don't know if it was on something else, a compilation,
no, Problems,
or on the MySpace
was page. On
or something
else, but or it was leaked, but Problems was out early because a lot of people heard Problems. I know I heard Problems early.
Same. And it's a really satisfying song. There's something in the way that song moves is really great.
An inventory has been taken of every
It's very funny though, and I know you're a bit of a student of this, but I'm pretty sure Problems is the least listened to song on this record, which is crazy.
Which is because it's 12 on a 14 track album. It's 47 minutes long.
And the lead single comes after it. So you're not going to bleed into it, and it might as well be last.
You can sort of flip this record almost and throw these last, I mean, if you honestly just invert the record, turn it completely upside down, it's a completely different experience. If you went from Searching into Don't Lose Touch into Problems, that to me feels like an album that is primed to be kind of a breakthrough smash.
It's blowing my mind right now to contemplate that. You're so right about that.
And then you go, Even in Our Worst, We're Still Better Than Most. And then you get to Joy a little bit earlier, and then the political songs kind of ground down at the end, and Miami becomes sort of like this like hungover closer.
Yeah.
I hate stopping talking about Problems because there's so much of it. I think that it is just one of my favorite Against Me songs because of the way it turns from this kind of like strum outy, like loose kind of like we're going to roll into something, into that big clattering chorus that is just a perfect distillation of what they do. It's like everything good about the first two albums in one song, and I think that it does it better than a lot of the fan favorites from the early days. I think it just nails it. But Searching for a Former Clarity is such an arresting song because it makes a perfect intro track, it makes a perfect, you know, intro to the set, but there's like no argument among anybody that this should not be the closer. Everyone knows this is the exact only song that could close the record. And it has to be the title track, and it has to be the end, because it's an intro track. It's built like an intro track. It's a long, long build up to a little bit of a payoff.
It's like that that pup record that if the tour doesn't kill me going into that other song, it could accomplish that.
Yes, it's like it's building up to that steamroll moment, and then it goes kind of nowhere. It cuts out pretty quick because it's clearly an intro track construction, but I think it's very much intended to be like, this is the intro to where we are going. Yeah. This is the intro to the Against Me coming. And we've told you over and over on this record, you can get on board or fuck you. But this is who we are, and this is who we're going to become. And it is the clearest statement. Laura Jane Grace had begun to transition at this time and had not talked to the band or many people about the journey. But this song is very clearly the first time that she is writing about that experience in a close to explicit way. You can hear it elsewhere throughout the record a little bit. There's ways on Pretty Girls, The Mover, which is kind of a really loser track about girls not liking you in some ways.
Yeah,
but then there's this moment that really changes the context of the song where she says, you know, there are things that can't be undone. There's mistakes that can't be forgiven. Sometimes at night, I pray to wake a different person.
Yep.
The struggle that she is facing and the reason her relationships are not working out and the way that things is because there's not a connection she can make because she is not the person she wants to be. And can't successfully be this version of herself who struggles with addiction and interpersonal relationships and is kind of confrontational and bouncing off things and sharp angles. And you hear it little bits and pieces throughout this idea, this deep discomfort with who she is as a person. And Searching is where she like kind of verbally says that for the first time.
I have this like specific memory of reading the Rolling Stone article about Laura Jane Grace and just really just like sitting with it slowly. Like, this feels really important and notable. And in that moment, like in the years since then, you go back and you can find the things that may or may not be referencing that. But I didn't need to do that in regard to Searching for a Form of Clarity. Like, that song entered my mind as I read that thing. It's sitting there. You don't need to. It really feels like it's an amazing closing track. And I remember thinking that at the time too, like it's a powerful, you just sort of die. The record just kind of dies in song form, you know?
Yeah. And there's this great, and it doesn't even, it's such a clear statement regardless of her identity as a trans woman. Just that statement, will everyone you ever meet or love be just a relationship based on a false presumption? Despite everyone you ever meet or love, in the end, will you be all alone?
Confessing childhood secrets of dressing up in women's clothes, compulsions you never knew the reasons to. Will everyone you ever meet or love be just a relationship based on a false presumption? Despite everyone you ever meet or love,
and it's this idea of this inability to be anything other than fake. Who you are fundamentally in every relationship you have, you know they are not connecting with you, who you are. There is something, there's a construction that you've put up, there is a person that you believe you have to be, and you are, all your relationships are being filtered through that. And because of that, none of them are functional, none of them are working, none of them are reaching you where you are. And this is a really funny, I think that Laura Jane Grace is a great writer, but is very visceral, very physical, very immediate.
Yep.
And she's not very similar at all to someone like John K. Samson of the Weaker Thans, who's super cerebral, super bookish, very dweeby, and very poetic.
Yeah.
But these last lines of Searching for a Form of Clarity on paper to me read like one of the many closing songs on Weaker Than's albums and John K. Samson records. This reads exactly like a John K. closing track when it says, "Let this be the end, let this be the last song, let this be the end, let all be forgiven.
Let this be the end, let this be the last song, let this be the end, let all be forgiven."
Boom, done. Something about that song and then the record title, like you have like a phrase like reinventing Axl Rose or like as the eternal cowboy, very not, there's no cliche in them. They're like titillating and interesting and sort of like, what is that? And searching for a form of clarity. I want to try and like batch up multiple things like this, but it's like sort of like punk band album title version of like the like thing you'd buy at Home Goods and put up in your kitchen or whatever. Mm-hmm. It can sound that way. The other ones that I came up like this are Something to Write Home About and On the Impossible Past. But then if you allow yourself to enter in and like be with it, it's a very pertinent title to that song and this record. It's like it's doing all the work it needs to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's only on its surface that I remember thinking, searching for a form of clarity. What are we talking about?
It is the jean jacket patch version of a Home Goods Live Laugh Love sign. It's absolutely, it's in like On the Impossible Past. It's kind of like what you would, it is like punk band Mad Libs, exactly like what you'd expect. But I think like a lot of this record that is unexpectedly polished, is unexpectedly, confrontational to their fans of all people, is like very glib about trying to make money. I think the title is deeply sincere.
It is, yeah, it's good.
Which is like very little on the record. There's spaces on the record. This is in many ways the most sincere thing they've done. They've done a lot of punk sloganeering that's very sincere and not ironic at all. But this is kind of the most letting down the persona mm-hmm. a little bit and being a little bit more of a human being on record. But the title is the most sincere thing about the record. And it is kind of saying, you have to come into this understanding that we mean all of it. And we're going to do jokes and we're going to do some middle fingers and we're going to do some goofball shit. But you have to understand that by the time you get to the end, we have meant everything we said. And it isn't a bit and it isn't a joke and it's not for fun. Like there's something life and death about the record that is different.
That's very well put.
As we become a band that talks about ourselves in a sincere and kind of raw way, the complications are getting worse. It's not simplifying anything. It's making the dissonance more upsetting and difficult to deal with and difficult to reconcile.
To that end, I think that it's kind of a beautiful artifact, this whole record, because it's cool that Fat Mike is like, this doesn't look like a punk record. What is this? And in a lot of ways, it just isn't one, you know? It's like, it has the trappings of some kind of like, it feels like an art project, like this, the cover, the sincere title, the very small font, almost half the songs feeling like mid-tempo, mm-hmm. and then all this confessional stuff on one hand is like a big expansive like exploration of all these things, which you can characterize it that way as something great and cool and awesome and admirable, but it's very easy to flip that over and just be like, this is bloated and unfocused and long, and nothing has ever felt long or like it's taking up my time about Against Me ever. And it literally does feel this way in multiple spots when I've listened to this record, which is confusing because it's also good.
Right. I think it doesn't always execute the way it wanted to. I think there are ways that I do agree the record is kind of over full. I think that Violence and Justin could go and you wouldn't really feel the impact at all on the record. And then you would lose
at least seven minutes off the top. I would feel an impact.
Correct. Now there's less Justin representation.
Yeah. Justin, I think like Justin is the song that it is. I kind of like it, but I also, it was my moment of like, oh, hell yeah. I got literally my favorite band with a song with my title on it. And the little lyric where it says my name is, you know, Justin. Well, Justin's dead. And then if you want to keep going, Yahoo won't let his family have access to his email account, which I'm not going to lie, has like stayed in my head multiple times through life. Like, when you die, can people access these things?
That's a great detail. It's such a fascinating, no, it's a great song. It just is like such a, you know, political statement on a record that is more personal. but I think that they didn't want to lose that. And so I think they just did both things.
Right.
And I understand that even if the record gets long, but I think that the centerpiece of the record, and it was my favorite song for a long time from them, is Joy. It's a song that Laura Jane does a couple times on different records. This like stripped down acoustic song. It's oftentimes a closer for things. And it's a little glib. It's a little bouncy. It's a little sing-songy or gentle in some way that the other songs aren't. The rest of the record deals kind of more intimately with the stuff that isn't joyful. That is like the complications or the messes.
Yeah. Life doesn't sound that fun for this band at this particular moment.
Correct. The band sounds fucking exhausted.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great songs, but there has never been a band who is more unexcited to deal with their fans or deal with this moment or to release a record at all.
Even just like song title scan, like the word joy contrasts that against problems. How low, violence, mediocrity gets you paired. Like it's just in tone is not saying joy. It's not giving joy.
And it's why joy is tucked in the middle of the record, but it's kind of like an important like part of the record. It's like, no, we don't actually see an answer out of this. You know, I shrug the question off, continue to get high. Like, obviously I'm buried in my problems and this record's not going to resolve here. The record ends on a much bleaker note. And I think that's the driving force of the record is that discomfort and uncertainty. But the fact that the record strips down in the middle to just this quiet little assurance that there is a joy in every possibility is such a great. And because there's so much kind of slow stuff leading into this one, it feels like a little respite, a little breather.
Joy accomplishes something with Against Me. Let's see if I can describe this. As the Eternal Cowboy succeeds sort of in the sense that like they say they didn't even write the record and they just kind of crammed it out and here it is. It's fast as hell and you're going to yell to some of this stuff and boom, it's gone. There's no stakes to that for them. It's sort of like, this is what you get when we fucking bang something out. Whereas this, they're taking what feels like the risk of trying to do a bunch of things. And therefore now you get to like judge them on it. You know, it's like the sort of like setting your own expectations, but joy plucks from something, like you said, some previous Against Me thing, which is like, this is mostly two chords, mostly just an acoustic guitar. The verses are just little specific moments plucked from like what feels like a person walking through a crowd or something. And in the middle of that is the chorus saying there's a joy in all I can see. The contrast of all that is just sort of like, it's one of those ones that you could be like the thing where they say Dolly Parton wrote those two songs in the same day or whatever. It's like Laura Jane Grace banged out Joy in one sequential, like written out thing on piece of paper in 30 minutes. And that's what you have on the record. Who knows if that's true or not, but it just feels like Joy was just sitting there and it just got plucked out of the world and now we hear it on this record.
All is quiet except for this song. So maybe while I'm not together, I can feel like I'm not alone. Somewhere off in the distance, rapidly advancing, it's an onslaught of sorts, young sirens wail in a skewed sense of glory, and the lions in the cages roar a memory of fight. And there's a joy in all I can see, a joy in every possibility.
This was not an Against Me record I loved for a long time growing up because it just isn't obviously one thing. Like As the Eternal Cowboy and Axl Rose are obviously one thing. And I think that the Cowboy is kind of even a better version of the Axl Rose thing. And then I think Transgender Dysphoria Blues takes such a big, clear swing at these huge choruses and nails it and really reinvented, I think, what the band was capable of. And I think in hindsight, people went back to like White Crosses, which was, you know, universally hated when it dropped by existing fans. And I think people are really warm to it now because it became so clear with Transgender Dysphoria Blues what the band was doing, what they were capable of, and the kind of...
Yeah. I'm a data point in what you just described. I did that. I straight up listened to New Wave because obviously I just would. And then just was like, that's my version of being too cool for it or whatever when White Crosses. And then I went back to it and I found a lot to like. Here's a little thing just while we briefly pass by White Crosses. This is fucking crazy to me. But Baby I'm an Anarchist has 8 million streams. White Crosses song I Was a Teenage Anarchist, 28 million streams.
Mm-hmm.
People are listening to White Crosses.
It's and you know, as something so silly about that song, but it's like a really undeniable set of hooks. And I think that something about Transgender Dysphoria Blues was so confident and so clear in the mission that suddenly the shit on White Crosses that felt like, are they trying to, like, what are they trying to do? It kind of cast a new light on it and kind of highlighted what the band was good at and what they were always good at. And you start to see that a little bit on Searching for a Former Clarity, that kind of like pop sensibility that doesn't really deviate from their sound as much as kind of funnel it in a different direction. But Searching for a Former Clarity isn't doing one thing at all. In fact, it's overstuffed because it's doing several things at the same time. And I didn't love it for that reason, but I think now I probably is my second favorite album of theirs overall. Everything in their past and in their future is present in one record.
Very good. Very well put.
They're at a turning point where in the roller, they say, feels like you've already said so much. Feels like you can never say enough. Like, how much more do we have to do to prove ourselves? Let someone else take our place. Let's just, let this be the end. Let this be the last song. Let it be fucking over, because there's no point. But in this record, you hear what is going to like crystallize later into these big, like enormous choruses and big room punk songs that really, I think, don't trade in what they do for something worse, but blow it out until it becomes something different. Kind of in the same thing a band like Jimmy Eat World did, where they just continued to shape and refine what they were doing until it was just so big it had to move to a big room.
Yeah. It, what's going to be interesting is tomorrow talking to, I talked tomorrow to the musician Ben Lee, who covered New Wave when it came out, and I think has literally none of this, I don't know, I shouldn't say this, but none of this baggage of the previous 10 years of expectations and things, just like, this is amazing. I love this. I'm literally in 2007 or whenever that came out, going to cover it. That's just not what someone like you or me, or multiply that by everyone who was into all those previous records, took into what followed this. But I think you've articulated, like, we're almost just really across these songs, and maybe it's like telling that it like goes for so long and everything, and then kind of ends with like some version of a death for this iteration of the band. You know, we're just watching it be like, we're tired, we're fucking abusing ourselves, everyone hates us. There's this whole other thing that is like she's clearly processing, that's going to manifest and come through later. And it's just like, we're hitting the fucking, we're cutting the cord and fuck it. We're signing. We're making a record with Butch Vig. Why not?
You can decide what you want to think about us, but we can tell you that we're exhausted and we can't do this anymore. Whatever this is, whatever credibility we had, whatever you think about us, whatever goodwill we're losing or actual changes we're making, the only thing we're certain of is that we cannot keep doing it this way, and we're going to have to figure out a new way to exist if we're going to exist at all.
There's no winning this game. We're just going to not play it. Like, there's no. Yeah, well, what's fascinating is the previous season of this show was about Bright Eyes, and this record in a certain way reminds me of the record Casadega. Like, because then I was in, that was my real time getting into it, and it feels long, and it feels bigger, and both of them were ones that I was like, I'm seeing the tour, I'm buying it the day it comes out, and I try to convince myself for like 6 months that I love it, even though it's the first time I've ever been slightly let down. You know,
it's funny, Casadega is my favorite Bright Eyes record, and it was a similar thing where it was like, not, I remember it coming out and it feeling different and hearing it and thinking that this was like not kind of what I had expected of the band. And almost like it felt more like a Conor Oberst solo record, because his stuff was much, you know, kind of more Americana.
Right.
That's the reason I think that that record and this one continue to mean a lot to me when my relationship with that band's early work kind of changes, and how it's like less, it's not something I emotionally connect to the same way. It's like an interest. It's a nostalgic feeling for something I identified with and now enjoy revisiting, but don't have the same emotional pull to. But Searching for a Former Clarity and Casadega both are records that are suspicious, that are tired, that are conflicted, that are in many ways unhappy. And I think that the push to find something in that, the push to like get through that and to bang out some shape or outline of meaning and purpose in the midst of that. Yeah, you know, I was searching for a form of clarity too long, not well sequenced, and is in many ways hilariously antagonistic about the money they're making or not making in ways that are inconsistent and they change from song to song. But it, I think for that reason, it's just the one that still feels the richest when I come back to it. There's so much in it. And it's a band who says they're at war with their fans. It's actually at war with themselves. And I think that that two-layer tension is what makes this record just constantly feel a little bit different every time I come back to it.
That's, I think that that puts a cap on it pretty well. The and I think Casadega is like a record that's really like risen in estimation over time with time. And maybe this one will too. I read the like Laura Jane Grace ranked her records on Noisy and ranked this one last, which is for some of the reasons we're talking about now, just fascinating to think about. I don't know. I could see there's a lot to mine out of this record, and I could see it maybe if Against Me comes back at some point, I don't know. I could see it rising in people's estimation. It's an interesting period for them.
I agree. I was surprised at how many thoughts I had about the record on revisiting.
Totally. Tegan, thank you for coming on this show. Where can people find you, whether it's your music, things you write, things you do on the internet?
I am at Franziamom on Twitter, where I spend most of the time talking about music that I like. I write about music occasionally for places like Paste and Stereo Gum. You can find my writing there. And I'm in a band called Camp Trash, and we are working on our second album, which we will be recording in the spring of 2024. So we'll be getting back out on the road, hopefully spring, summer next year sometime.
Killer. And Camp Trash is from Florida, right?
Yeah, we're all spread out all over the place these days, but the singer and drummer for Camp Trash are still located in Bradenton, Florida. And so
where in the state is that?
That's just south of Tampa. So there on the West Coast. And we got together a couple weeks ago and kind of banged out the track list for the second record. So we entering a different phase of the band, changing things up slightly, hopefully getting louder, getting shorter songs and getting to the point quicker. I'm just excited for a new phase.
I think you should come back to them with like four extra 5-minute mid-tempo songs and say, throw these in there. I got a vision.
We've got to clear the 40-minute mark.
Yeah,
there's a new rule in the band where nothing clears 3 minutes unless it's the best thing we've ever written, because we just believe there's so much that we'd like to do that we're just going to try and get to the point and get to the core of what makes our songs good, hopefully. So.
Count me in. I love that. I love that rule and can't wait to hear it. And thank you not only for everything you've offered as it relates to this record and this band, but also for the Florida geography lesson you gave us today. I think it actually was of service.
Well, happy to be of service.
Tegan, thank you.
Thank you, Justin.
Do you want to go straight from this episode right into the episode about New Wave featuring the musician Ben Lee? Well, that episode is live right now at patreon.com/afterthedeluge. Ben covered that record basically like a month after it came out, and we talk about everything from the sound of that record, what kind of pressure you put on yourselves when you make something with the guy who made Nevermind, and even the sort of like self-policing psychology around what it means to sell out or what it means to exist within the current backdrop of the music industry, which is always changing, always evolving or devolving. This one gets borderline therapeutic if you're someone who's into making things or the arts or concerns yourself with the expectations of others around you. Ben Lee, interesting person to talk to about all of that, and I'm glad I got to talk about Against Me's major label debut with him. That's live, patreon.com/afterthedeluge.
I'm oh so fascinated. I am oh so entertained. Standing here like a comedian. I repeat what I say again and again and again until the meeting has become an imitation of itself. An impression of an original defeats a fucking purpose. I don't know where this is going, but it's looking more and more like the same place that we started. Well, good God, holy shit, a jump start.